Hey, good afternoon, everyone. It's Thursday, and the article that we have for you today is from the Christian Post Reporter. The date is March 11, 2018. Leonardo Blair, in an isolated world of pastors, churches mum on troubling clergy suicides. The first sentence says, in the fall of 2011, the Reverend Teddy Parker Jr.'s wife found him in the driveway of their Warner Robins home in Georgia with a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Many were stunned. By the way, I bet you we could grab a parallel article and talk about the military.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The suicide in the Department of Defense right now is at an all-time record-breaking high. And they're not addressing the problem, the root problems. All right, let's get started, Brian.
All right, Parker never believed in suicide and often admonished his parishioners against it. I'm very surprised because he didn't preach that. He preached totally against it. It's something that the congregation doesn't really understand. Russell Rowland, a member of the Bibb Mount Zion Baptist Church in Macon, Georgia, where Parker was the leader, said at the time, "Everybody is just kind of stunned right now. I think a lot of people are just trying to understand why that happened. We're just praying to the Lord for guidance on this," he said. A few months after Parker's death in April 2014, then pastor of Community Bible Church in High Point, North Carolina, Robert McKeehan, 42, was found hanging inside his home. He was the same age as Parker and was also a father of two. These pastor suicides have not just been an unfortunate isolated event. An alarming number of pastors have taken their own lives in the last 5 years, and despite the increasing prevalence of suicide nationally and the troubling rates at which the epidemic has been affecting certain groups of clergy, many churches remain silent on the issue. Parker's suicide came just 3 weeks ahead of Pastor Ed Montgomery's in 2013. 3 months later, it was the Reverend Alan Tommy Rucker. 2 months after that, it was Pastor Robert McKeehan. Less than a month later was Pastor D.B. Antrim. Then, 3 months later, it was the Reverend Bill Scott, who also killed his wife, Charlotte. Less than a year later, in May 2015, it was Phil Lineberger, former president of the Baptist General Convention of Texas and pastor of Sugar Land Baptist Church. 3 months after that, in August 2015, it was the Reverend Seth Euler. About a year later, in August 2016, it was Pastor Lawrence DeLong. Less than 6 months later, and just before Christmas on December 2016, it was Pastor Daniel Randall, who took the life of his 27-year-old daughter, Claire. Then, last December, after a brutal struggle with his mental health, suicide expert and senior pastor of Christ the Rock Community Church in Menasha, Wisconsin, Bill Lentz took his life also.
All right, that's quite the paragraph, and two paragraphs there. And obviously, somebody was paying attention and doing their research. Here's what I want to tell you, listener. We could write that exact same paragraph for soldiers, only instead of using months, we would say weeks.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And instead of saying weeks, we would say days. There's often a week in which, or a weekend in which Fort Bragg, there's three soldiers that commit suicide. It would be two in the 82nd, one in the Special Forces Group. It would be one in 10th Mountain Division, one in the 101st, one at the, I mean, these two paragraphs is something, and yes, these are pastors, but the suicide, if you just started running a rolling thing and you include the Marine Corps and the Coast Guard and the Navy and the Air Force, it's probably one and a half a day.
And isn't the, and I don't know how much of it is, just a statistic that people hear and repeat, but isn't the current purported number that about 22 veterans?
Oh, it's crazy. Yeah, the veteran suicide is
What is it? One veteran every 22 days commits suicide, and that's why they had that challenge, like 22 push-ups a day to raise suicide awareness mm-hmm. in the veterans mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. Things of that nature. It's high.
Yeah, and I don't. And if we're gonna, kind of take a step back and look at the broader idea of not just handling with pastors. Is the idea of suicide and where it comes from and, how people get to that point of wanting to take their own life. And, while none of us in the room are mental health professionals, and I'm sure that those individuals would have something to say about it, I just can't help but think about everything that we see in our world that includes death is usually some ploy of Satan to try to undo what God has done.
Sure.
That he tries to break down marriage, he tries to break down the church, he tries to break down the very life that God breathed into the nostrils of man.
I'm sorry, it's 22 veterans a day
die
from suicide. And the suicide rate in the U.S. military is 30 to every... Let me back it up. Look at it one more time. 30 to every 100,000, and the civilian rate is 14 to every 100,000. So the military is twice as many as the civilian rate.
Wow. And I don't think we have any kind of numbers like that in for this pastoral particular focus.
You know, this news clipping says, from this is Getty Images, American flags stand at the National Mall Thursday, March 27, the year 2014 in Washington, D.C. The flags represent each of the 1,892 veterans and service members who has died by suicide this year. 1,892. So that's five a day, five to six a day. Between all the branches of the service and veterans. All right, so troubling statistics according to this article. Let's continue.
A 2016 data brief from the CDC National Center for Health Statistics said from 1999 through 2014, the age-adjusted suicide rate in the United States increased 24% from 10.5 to 13 per 100,000, with the pace of increase greater after 2006. Suicide rates, the brief said, increased for both male and females and for all ages 10 to 74. The rates are at the highest level in nearly 30 years, a federal data analysis showed. Data illustrating this jump shows that in raw numbers, the total number of people who died by suicide nationally jumped from 29,199 in 1999 to 42,773 in 2014. While no one knows for sure the exact number of pastors who are among those who die by suicide, the National Occupational Mortality Surveillance Database, which includes records on almost 4 million deaths during the period 1999, 2003 through 2004, and 2007 to 2012, provides a studied estimate on how many pastors are affected. In examining deaths by profession, this CP reporter looked at data provided to the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health by 23 selected state vital statistics offices and the National Center for Health Statistics. The NIOSH calculates the proportionate mortality ratios, or PMR, when data for the population at risk are not available and death rates cannot be computed. A PMR will tell you if there is a greater proportion of suicides in a profession compared to the general population. A PMR above 100 is considered to exceed the average background risk compared to all occupations. Julie Eschelbach, health communications specialist for the CDC's National Center for Injury Prevention and Control, explained, "Looking at the data for all clergy combined, regardless of sex or race, the PMR of 70 does not exceed the average background risk. When the data is broken down by sex and race, however, black male and white female clergy members showed elevated PMRs of 110, while the PMR for white male clergy stood at 52. Counseling experts who track research on mental health among pastors are also raising concerns. While acknowledging that he wasn't aware of any specific studies that looked specifically at suicides among pastors, Dr. Jared Pingleton, Vice President of Professional Development at the American Association of Christian Counselors, who is a licensed clinical psychologist and credentialed minister, said of the suicide rate among clergy, "I wouldn't be surprised if it's not at least as high as the general population. I wouldn't be surprised if it's higher." Chuck Hannaford, a clinical psychologist who consults for the Southern Baptist Convention, told the Gospel Coalition in 2016 that he believes the rate of pastor suicides has increased during his 30 years of practice and suggested the problem was worsening. "Being a pastor is a dangerous job," he said, "especially in certain evangelical circles where you have more of a fundamentalist orientation theologically. You find pastors who will reduce their depression or their negative thought process to strictly spiritual problems." The silence. The Christian Post reported on each of the pastor suicides highlighted in this report, but church staff caring for the affected families and congregations all declined to discuss the matter publicly, especially in the days and weeks following the tragic events. For example, Lakeisha Toomer, a Bibb Mountain Zion Baptist Church official, told CP in 2013, "We consider this a private matter between the family and the BMZ church family. We kindly ask that the public respects our privacy at this time." More than 4 years later, when asked if he was willing to share anything from the experience of losing a pastor to suicide in February, Paul Little, the church's new senior pastor, said the time wasn't yet right. "I'd be willing to do something, just trying to make sure the family is comfortable. I think it's necessary for us to tell the story, but we also have to be sensitive to the timing as well." Pingleton explained that the reluctance of churches to openly discuss suicide and other mental health issues is one of the reasons the problem endures. "I attribute what you experience to what I call the unholy trifecta, silence, shame, and stigma. About mental health issues, and especially suicide being the chief of those, there is a deafening silence," he said. "And there is a pervasive shame which causes us to hide from Genesis 3 on, and then there is this consistent stigma for mental and relational health problems because suicide is a relational thing. It's not just a mental thing. It is often referred to as the ultimate act of self-centeredness, for example, or the ultimate act of last revenge, to play the quintessential or penultimate guilt trip on one's loved ones," he continued. "We need to end the silence, eradicate the shame, and erase the stigma because there's still so much to deal with. It's against the rules to struggle in a church. You don't have enough faith. You don't read the Bible enough. You need to pray more. We would never say to someone with diabetes or cancer that you shouldn't take medication."
And what parallel is he trying to draw here?
That if you struggle with diabetes, it's, well, of course you need to take your insulin. You know, don't ignore your, you know, your sugar intake simply because, you know, it's not directly dealt with biblically. That you need to pray more about your insulin levels. Or maybe you should just be praying about the cancer treatments as opposed to chemo or radiation. And so since those are real medical issues, real health issues that have medical treatments, we shouldn't just say that suicide or mental health is, well, you know, that's just the devil beating you up and you just need to read your Bible a little bit more. Instead, maybe there should be, maybe you should, you know, speak with a counselor or a psychologist about that.
Thoughts on that? Steve, you'd be one of those fundamentalists that they're talking about there. Yeah, that more of a fundamentalist orientation theologically.
Yeah, I don't know if they're more prone to depression or negative thoughts, though. In my mind, in some ways, there's more freedom in that, because if you know what, and Jack and I were talking about this last week, you know, if you have your rules of do's and don'ts, it's pretty cut and dried. You know what you can do, what you can't do, and you know, so you're, as long as you're content within that, you're good. You know, you're not a lot to, you know, you don't know what you're missing because you don't really care to know. It's kind of the attitude there. So, you know, I would say 20 years ago, I would have agreed with his comment there about, you know, just tell somebody, you know, you need to read your Bible and pray more. You know, that it is just the devil. But I think in today's society or, vernacular, I think many people, I think it goes beyond that. You know, and I think that a good Christian counselor can help. Or is it would be better to go see one and get some help from them than it is just to, you know, tell somebody, you know, just pray. And a lot of that is people, you know, they read their Bible, but they don't really, they're not studying it. They're not really getting into it.
They're not meditating.
They're not asking the Holy Spirit to give them direction. They're not really following the direction from the Lord anyway. And, you know, I think the reason for their depression is not just, well, I haven't been reading my Bible and have my devotions. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's deeper seed problems there that they need to share and needs to come out and needs to be dealt with.
But I think too, and I think this works even with what we're talking about, Pastor, with the military. maybe even more with active duty than with the veterans, and certainly with the pastors, is this essence of isolationism. The fact of the matter is how confident would you be as a senior pastor of this church if you were struggling with depression, having that publicly known and not fearing for your position as leader? That automatically kind of relegates you to maybe you have one or two competent people that you can talk to, you have confidence in, but for the most part you're by yourself and you're left to struggle with it by yourself. And even though you pray, you're really dealing with something that's very, very deep rooted, and there's this unbelievable cyclic fear that you have no one to turn to. And eventually you get to where Paul was at in Romans 7, "Oh, wretched man that I am," and you're never making it to 8, that I have no condemnation, and you feel condemned because you feel less than what you know you should be or what you think you should be as a leader. I would say that Elijah definitely is probably in that same cycle when he climbed up into the cave. Mm-hmm. Believing he was all alone, and God had to remind him there's 700 men who would be there with you.
7,000.
7,000, yeah. But, and I think with the military, you know, these guys, they lose their combat operative status.
Mm-hmm. Lose your secret security clearance.
They lose their security clearances. They can't go and talk to people. They can't, even in trusting of a counselor, are you serious? What if somebody finds out, so I'm not going to go to anybody, and I take it out on my family? It affects my home life, and you know that shouldn't happen. So then there's the guilt of that begins to weigh even more upon it. And you begin to think, you know what, it would be better if I just went home to heaven. It would probably just be better if I went home to heaven, because surely I'm going to bring everything to ruin here. And then you got the veterans who, everybody that was there with them, going through it with them, are no longer there. They're back in their civilian communities, and people don't understand where they've been and what they've gone through, and Facebook isn't adequate to make the connections that's needed to prevent this. And the truth is that in today's modern church, we lack the transparency that you can stumble and know that your brothers and sisters are going to be there to hold you up. You know, you preached on Moses up on the mountain.
We talked about that last night with James.
Well, you preached on Moses. Where's her? Lifting the arms.
I think that's a knee-jerk reaction of, or just a trail on, of the independent fundamental Baptist church of the 50s, 60s, 70s, and the 80s, where, you know, the pastor was the man of God. No, and he was, in so many words, the vicar of Christ for that local church, that no one had closer access to God. If you wanted to know the answer to something, you went and spoke to the pastor, and they didn't value the priesthood of the believer like they should have.
But I would agree with you if it wasn't for the fact that the rates are so high in the African-American pastor community.
True.
Yeah, I would say that the demographic that you're describing is the
lower white male demographic, right? Described.
Right, and that's the piece that I didn't really understand with the article making particular reference to the fundamentalists, because especially in certain evangelical circles where you have a more fundamental orientation theologically. Okay, well, here's the reality. That's white males.
Well, and I think his point there is that, once the... maybe I'm misreading or misinterpreting, but, that demographic would have had more of the compensity, is that the right word?
Propensity
to, lift themselves up as a demagogue, and then when they, and he gets to it later, when they have sexual misconduct or they fall from that, they feel like their lives are ruined and they can't save face, so they just commit suicide. Hmm. So it's, I think maybe he's trying to draw that parallel or pull that in, he will later.
But I think what's being said right now at this point in the article is people wake up and realize men are men. Whether they're leaders and pastors, they're still men. And if your pastor had a legitimate body sickness, not a mental illness, but a legitimate body sickness, there's no way you would want him to deny himself medical care, deny himself professional counseling with a nutritionist if it was diabetes like you mentioned, mm-hmm. things of that nature. Why then would we not openly make it known that, hey, we understand if you have to go and talk to somebody because the pressures of the job is so great. I mean, Pastor Sean deals with, his life is consumed with looking at the sin of the world, it being God's spokesman against it, looking at the ills of our flock and its sicknesses of sin and where they exist, and the constant barrage of negativity that he's supposed to be able to help people wade through. How can it not drag upon his emotional state? And are we being the hearers as a congregation to him?
Well, and it's the author already stated it, but there's this silence, shame, and stigma that's placed on it.
Exactly. And I think that's what he's saying is if we recognize it as a cold, if we recognize it as the flu, if we recognize it in the same regards, we would want to have it healed properly as fast as possible so they can get back to being as effective as they possibly can be mm-hmm. under the guidance of God.
So yeah. Because, you know, I must admit, I've done it too. Why do you think that someone who struggles with thinking incorrectly or someone who struggles with depression, why do we see that as different than having the cold or the flu? I mean, what are the reasons? Because obviously we don't see them the same.
I think because, you know, we understand in a warped mindset, we know, you know, if I have diabetes, other than, you know, if I can change my diet and cure it, then that's on me. But, you know, right. if my body doesn't produce insulin, I can't change that. You know, I can't help that I got a cold. You know, okay, so somebody coughed in my face. I couldn't prevent that. But we feel like with our minds that, you know, if I just think the right thoughts, if I meditate on the Word of God like I'm supposed to, if I'm controlled by the Spirit and filled with the Spirit every day, every moment of the day, then I won't have negative thoughts. I won't criticize. I won't, you know, have all these issues. And so it's somehow it's my fault because I'm not focused on the right things. I'm not meditating on the right things.
And what we don't know, and this is the sad part about it, Jonathan, is, and I can't speak to some, because there's no medical information here as to what took place to that long list of pastors who committed suicide that opened up the article and got our attention. But we can go to like a guy like Robin Williams, who I've heard many Christians just beat up that he took his life and everything else. But it was found out that he had a protein deficiency in the cellular structure of his brain that created an emotional instability, and those proteins were susceptible to being broken down at a faster rate when put on antidepressant medicine. So in other words, the medicine that was supposed to help him actually deteriorated him at an even faster rate to create the instability that led to him taking his life. Where had they known that he had this rare disease, they could have treated it differently and he might still be living today. Now, that's not an endorsement in his life. That's not an endorsement of him as an actor or anything else. But it is a medical case where sometimes it isn't just the thought process. There may actually be something far deeper rooted. But yet, he himself still battled with the stigma of supposed to be the happy-go-lucky guy, that it was hard for him to go and seek treatment.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I think that stems off of that is for hundreds, if not thousands of years, okay, you have this medical treatment of different things going on where you knew there were natural clotting agents for a flesh wound, that there were herbs and things that were supposed to do that, because it's very, as you said, we don't see it the same because we don't see it. I mean, and even diabetes, you end up getting some sort of outworking that, okay, the person collapses or they pass out. You know, we have some of those physical things that we don't have with mental health. And so I can see that you broke your leg while you were skiing, or I can see that your nose is running. I can't see that your mind is struggling. And so it's hard for me to identify with that because I can't see it.
And, you know, this is interesting because I was thinking about this morning. You know, if you have someone who's raised in a household without a, let's just say, for the sake of argument, not taking it too in such a strange different direction, but understand what I'm saying. If someone's raised in a house without a biblical worldview, and just over and over, there's no biblical worldview, you know, and they're even raised with a parent who just tells them over and over, you're worthless, you know, why can't you be like your brother? I mean, we all know that there's relationships between fathers, sons, mothers, daughters that are just like that, that from day one they're just told. And then you take another child that's raised in a loving home, you know, the reason that we respect you is because you're creating the image of God. I mean, it's no surprise that when you get to seventh grade, these two individuals think so differently. Mm-hmm. And you ask yourself, well, what I was struggling with this as, you know, I was just thinking about this morning in contemplation was, you know, we want to get on the person for thinking the way they do. But in some sense, it's just like something that's out of their control. Because we know that doing something over and over and over creates a habit. And when it wasn't even their choice to have it done to them over and over, such as in the case of a parent who never is approving, who always, no matter what you try to do, you can't ever please them. And, you know, so, you know, where is that line between human responsibility and the nature and nurture thing, if you want to go to the psychological discussion? And that's what makes this so complex. And I struggle at it, just an answer, like a silver bullet. Well, here's the answer. Write it down. You know, I've got 5 points for you, and you'll never commit suicide again. You know, that's just...
I don't know if you'd ever commit suicide again.
Okay. We won't have another suicide in the church if you would just follow these 5 things. But that's what we want.
Sure.
We want just like that, so simple, a good explanation. Why is this happening?
And like a glucose, you know, tester will solve all your diabetes issues.
Right.
So, all right, let's get into the pastor's burden.
Mark Medina is a transitional pastor who is helping Valley Presbyterian Church in Green Valley, Arizona, recover from the 2016 suicide of their late pastor, Larry DeLong. While he was not authorized to discuss DeLong's case, he said that in decades of coaching other pastors, he has found that many pastors struggle because they don't know how to self-differentiate. I work with high-conflict churches, and a lot of churches I know in the past that I have worked with, they don't know how to deal with conflict. And that's a lot of pastors that do not know how to deal with conflict. A lot of them don't have the skill set, and I'm talking about all kinds of pastors, he said. A lot of pastors lose their clergy objectivity that they get so enmeshed in a system they can't see their way through. A lot of the folks that I've worked with in helping them get out of difficult situations is to give them some skills on how to create an environment where you can have discussions and not take it personally. A lot of seminaries and Bible colleges do not teach people how to deal with conflict or to even mediate. So yes, you can have the gospel of Jesus Christ as your guiding light and things like that, but you still have to work in a church that is full of broken people. The pastor has to understand that he or she is also a broken person and has to rely on God, and also has to have the skill set to deal with a particular church. So that's why I'm always about working with pastors. To highlight the burden of the various roles that clergy often are called to play, researchers in a 2002 report called Mental Health Issues Among Clergy and Other Religious Professionals, a review of a research, and they cite the work of Dennis Orthner, a social work professor at the University of North Carolina on United Methodist Ministers. Orthner's national survey of 2,000 United Methodist ministers found that while pastors found their work to be rewarding, it was also seen as demanding. He noted that among their many responsibilities, pastors are required to fill a variety of roles at once, including administrator, teacher, preacher, counselor, and fundraiser. There are a few times when pastors are not on call, and they often must deal with persons who are severely troubled. In their role as counselors, the report notes, researchers have found that pastors are the primary mental health counselors for tens of millions of Americans. They are frequently the first persons to help with a family or marital problem or a personal crisis. The National Institute of Mental Health also found that clergy are as likely as mental health specialists to have a person with a diagnostic and statistical manual of mental illness disorders diagnosis come to them for help.
When it came to clergy and their own mental health, however, the authors of the study, who looked at five databases of medical, nursing, psychology, religious, and sociological research on a group of 250 religious professionals spanning the period of 1975 to 2000, found Protestant clergy suffered the most work-related stress and had low levels of coping support. Among the group, Protestant clergy had the highest overall work-related stress and were next to the lowest in personal resources to cope with the occupational strain. Ministers, especially those who were sole pastors, indicated that they frequently felt isolated and had few friends and colleagues to turn to for help. Many Protestant clergy expressed concern about their inability to set time limits, show their vulnerability, or express appropriate anger with parishioners.
All right, that's a great stopping point. It's a lot of what you were already saying, Jack. And it doesn't, you know, they're living in this isolation, and that's really problematic.
It is. And just the sheer bombardment that you deal with on a daily basis. I would say 80% of my day is dealing with complaints.
Negative.
Here you thought you were the head of school. You're just the complaint department.
You know, it's funny because
we joke over there that if we had a dollar for every time somebody comes through our door,
pay attention
to complain, we could retire next year. If we split it between the three people that work in that room,
mm-hmm. It might not be that.
You
good,
should do that.
But
some places
but,
have a cuss jar. You need a complaint jar.
But some days it feels that way.
But I think, you know, a lot of the problem though is, I don't know that many pastors that are really trained to fill all those roles.
Right.
Sure. That's right. What he's saying.
You know, you're called upon to, you know, administrate, teach, preach, counsel, fundraise. Well, you know, that's a big...
And you're pretty much trained to preach.
Right. That's a big bucket list when, you know, you go to seminary or go to Bible college and, you know, your thought is, I'm going to teach and preach the Word of God. You know, now all of a sudden I have all these other things, and I haven't been trained to be a counselor or, you know, raise funds and
deal with people.
All this other stuff. I mean, I can teach, I can preach, I can show them what the Word of God says. But you know, I'm not a marriage counselor per se. I'm not a mental health psychologist, and on. And yet, that's, you know, if you don't do that, then you're looked upon as a failure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you almost need several degrees, don't you?
Yeah. You know, and if you tell somebody, you know, I can't help you, you need to go see this oh, well, you know, I thought you were my pastor. You know, you're supposed to know everything. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, then you add in the idea of the average church is 100 people or less. And even if you did have a pastoral staff where one guy focused in counseling and one guy was administration and the other guy was in teaching and preaching, I mean, you're not going to have that the average-sized church.
I mean, just in my role as leading a Christian school, I've thought, Maybe the best thing I could do is go back and get a business degree,
mm-hmm.
a master's
right.
in business.
After you get your doctorate degree.
Yeah, after I finish this.
Right,
yeah.
right. Yeah.
Do you guys do this when you ride around, if you're traveling somewhere, especially like in North Carolina, South Carolina, those places in the South, are you just amazed how many churches there are? And so many, like, and sometimes just like the condition of the church. It's just like this shack.
Dump.
And you know, I go to myself, first of all, why are these churches here? And I always come back to the same thing, and maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I don't trust the Spirit of God enough, but I usually come back to the fact some guy somewhere is a know-it-all. He wants to be the senior pastor. And I've seen this before in ministry a lot. You know, a guy comes in and Bill, don't hear what I'm not saying, okay? But a guy will come in as an associate or whatever, and he'll get a better idea, and he'll want to go be a senior pastor. And I just think, as I go past these churches, why do they want to do that? Because now they're going to be in this position to where everybody expects them to know everything. And what I think part of the issue is, we've allowed that in our culture and society, and the reality is we should have pastoral staffs that have gifting, because, you know, Paul talks about gifting, and that, and not everybody's an eye. And so why not have, you know, complementary gifting, where I don't do what Dr. Wilson does, and Dr. Wilson doesn't do what you do. And so the idea is that, like we've been talking about elders. I mean, and the same idea we talked about when we talk about Moses, and he's like, why are you bringing all these people to you? You're going to kill yourself. Divide up the work. And we just have such a propensity to not do that. And, you know, and I just think to myself, what if we had less churches but they were better?
Well, and to follow on that, Jonathan, Bible colleges would probably do well to start training young men to remove the idea of domestic church planting.
Well, because we have these greener idea all the time.
Well, that's exactly what it is. Because why would I want to come into a ministry and try to fix the problems that already exist when I could start from the ground up? Rather than remodeling the house that has, you know, solid structure, I'd rather go and have my own house built. Yeah. And I know plenty of people that I went to Bible college with that they wanted to be a church planter. It's just like, why?
And at the end of the day, it comes down to I want to do things my way and I can't deal with conflict. Because, and part of the, I got to say, I think that has a lot to do with marriages that are failing as well. Because we got this idea that we're going to marry this person and fix them. We're going to change them. We have these blinders on, like we don't see reality. We don't see, well, this is the way she was when we were dating, so this is the way she's going to remain. No. And so we do the same thing with churches, and we do the same thing with just people in general. And we have not learned how to have these conflicts or differences of opinion and still love one another like Christ said to, and be unified. And, I mean, you made a great point in your message. Look, if everybody was unified because we all walk, talk, look, and breathe, and smell the same, that's not real unity. Mm-hmm. You know, it's when you're diversified and you still are on the same page that it's unity. When you disagree and you still can agree on Christ, that's unity. The other is just cookie cutter, and that surprises no one. You know, if you all think the same thing and you can get along, well, big deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all the Patriots fan want the Patriots to win the Super Bowl.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's not very hard to, that kind of unity is not hard to achieve.
But I think for the pastor, and back to his burden, we've got this idea, especially Brian, you point out a good point. They come out of Bible college with these false notions, once again, never being taught. How do I talk? You know, I got two people fighting in my office. Let's do that class exercise. Mm-hmm. No, they don't do that. You know, they want to talk about all these minute theological minutiae, you know, and come on, people. You're going to be dealing with people almost your whole life. You're not going to be sitting in your office writing theological books.
It would almost be better off if they focused more on handling people. I shouldn't say more on. Equal parts handling the Word of God with handling people.
Or handling the Word of God with, handling the people with the Word of God.
Family problems and unrealistic expectations. Ministry was also found to be placed much strain on the marriages of clergy who are expected to oftentimes meet numerous unrealistic expectations from their congregations. Researchers found that almost 1 in 3 pastors leaving ordained ministry had family difficulties. Clergy ranked 3rd in the percentage among professionals who are divorced. Some 21% of the UMC clergy studied cited poor communication as a major problem. 43% cited inadequate companionship. The most often cited area of discord were inadequate time with spouse, lack of affection, financial problems, not enough time with children, sexual relations, marital conflict was the most common among young pastors and those unhappy in their work with financial situation, the report explained. It was further noted that many pastors and their families are placed on a pedestal that makes it difficult for them to form normal friendships. This situation often results in feelings of loneliness, isolation in clergy families that lead to the fishbowl effect of living in the public eye. This limited social support creates stress for many clergy families.
I have I've been dealing with, not in depth, but we've been dealing with this one with our 2-year-old, where he has started to demonstrate his sinful nature in sharing toys and things in the nursery that my wife is very much, you know, concerned about what people will think when our child is misbehaving. Almost as if, like, okay, it doesn't matter that I'm the youth pastor. I'm just as much a sinner as every other dad in the church, and my 2-year-old is just as much a sinner as every other 2-year-old in the church. And so Sunday we had the opportunity to go out with another family that also has a 2-year-old, and we've gotten the car, and I'm like, see, Lauren? We're not the only family that struggles with 2-year-olds acting the way they should. Fortunately, it was a deacon, so he has to live in the glass fishbowl too, so.
And what's hard and difficult to balance and is not done well is the concept of one who rules his house well. That qualification in 1 Timothy 3. And what does that really realistically look like with a 2-year-old? Mm-hmm. For you as a dad and a pastor. You know, what does that realistically look like? And it carries so many unrealistic expectations. Or even the fact of the matter is sometimes you're just not compatible where you're at. Okay? But maybe your spouse has become very enamored with the community and isn't ready to leave. What do? You can't just go and get another job. You can begin to feel tied because there you are. Divorce isn't an option. Your marriage is in shambles. There's no escape. I mean, there's absolutely no escape. And at the same time, simultaneously, you still got to appear perfect because you can't lose your job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's just expectations are this crazy cycle in which, okay, I expect my pastor to have a perfect relationship with his family. Well, we all know that one of the best ways to have a great relationship with your family is to spend time with them. But what do I expect my pastor to do? Be spend on the end of the me. Phone at my beck and call.
And drop everything.
Drop everything. Well, those two are mutually exclusive. And so, that's the difficult piece is knowing where, okay, you know what? I'm not taking any more calls tonight.
Yeah.
I'll deal with it in the morning. But that, if you're a pastor around this table, that's hard to do. Because you know that at the end of the day, if a church member calls you, and this is probably, what your family is going to feel, you're going to pick up and you're going to go do that service for that church member because we feel called to do this, we feel duty bound to do this, or whatever.
And what we don't know is how much has the cell phone environment created the proliferation of that expectation. The idea that now, really, you're on call 24/7.
I don't know that Charles Spurgeon struggled with that as much.
Right, because somebody gets sick in the middle of the night. It wasn't a quick text message to my pastor and why isn't he here an hour later. It was somebody to relay the message the next morning when normal people got up and things were discovered and news broke out. And then the pastor moved through his day and addressed and everything else. Whereas today, you go to the hospital at 2:15 in the morning and your pastor's not there at 2:50, you're really upset. And you're even more upset if it's not the senior pastor and it's one of, one of the associates. I mean, what, I'm not good enough to have the senior pastor come and see me in the ER?
Well, let me go on the record and say that I think that this congregation is really good about that.
Right, but I'm just talking in general for the article.
Right, but I mean, I think, I don't really think that I don't feel that from our congregation the same way that you're describing, to be honest with you.
Well, even as one of, the pastoral staff. I mean, because he's right. There is a premium because your title starts with senior. People expect a little more. And even there have been times that people will reach out to me in an evening or, hey, I know you're busy. This isn't important. But, when you get time, could you do this? And it's like, you know what? Yeah, I'm not the senior pastor. But our congregation is still very considerate when it comes to that.
They are.
I was just going to say, I was not specifically speaking of our congregation.
No, right.
Neither was I.
But because you're right. You're right. But, I think that plagues a lot of places.
Yeah. I almost wondered to what degree it would have looked like in the New Testament. Because so many Baptist churches that fall into that model of, Pastor, I texted you, I need you here now, would purport that they are New Testament churches. And yet, how would that have looked in the New Testament? I mean, without a printing press, without, a switchboard even, 100 years ago with the telephone.
He probably texted back, busy with lions, get to you in a moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, let's skip the stress and sexual misconduct, the aftermath of the pastor's suicide. All right, in recalling the aftermath of suicide of his best friend Barnes, who delivered his eulogy, explain how it affected him personally as well as his congregation at large. So is this the... All right, well, obviously it is very, very painful. I think many in the congregants have become believers. All of them have been discipled by him, and he has been their pastor and teacher for years. He was very greatly loved. He'd been a good pastor. I think many people, of course, felt betrayed, but I will never forget the service. I think one of the essential things in such a setting is I think you encourage people to give voice to their pain and their feelings rather than cover it over. And I preached that day on Lamentations chapter 3, where Jeremiah speaks very passionately and very, very bluntly, painfully about a sorrow for his people. Yet at the end of the passage, there is hope. He said, in my sermon, I was encouraging the congregation to express their grief and also their anger. The Lord's quite capable of handling that and to be completely honest about the way they felt. In order for a church to heal from a pastor's suicide, Barnes explained that in his experience, people should be honest and open about how they really feel. That honesty, he said, can sometimes be expressed in unexpected ways. He then recalled how the congregation reacted when they went to bury his friend at the graveyard. All right, someone else?
And then they went to the graveyard, and I've never seen anything like it after. He said of the burial service he had expected to be brief. I put the first trowel full of dirt on his coffin, and some of his family who had come from other parts of the world did the same. Then the members of the congregation each started one by one putting a trowel full of dirt on the coffin, and they just started singing hymns. They actually were there for, I think, what must have been 3 hours or so until the whole grave, at just a trowelful at a time, was full. They were singing the whole time. I don't think the undertakers had ever seen anything like it either. It was just an outpouring of pain and love. It was just extremely moving, and I think that encouraging the congregation like that to express their sorrow was very important when somebody is grieving anything rather than pretending everything is fine. That was very important. That was a very important time in the healing of the congregation, and they lost very few members over the next year or two, he said. The church just carried on basically in a very straight line. There were a couple of people who left, and there were some other reasons for that, not because of their sense of anger or grief or betrayal, because they were encouraged to express that. Bars explained that the suicide of a pastor is not something that people forget, even after 25 years. I still talk to people about it from time to time who were elders with him and labored alongside him. It's just a sorrow that never goes, like losing a child. It's always there for the rest of your life. Changing church culture and remembering pastors are human too. To help break the lure of suicide as a solution for pastors, experts, including Pingleton and Bars, agree that churches and seminaries must improve the way they address issues of mental health in training schools from the pulpit. Pastors also need to develop a deeper self-awareness and learn how to create boundaries in their professional roles. What the research shows very clearly is that one out of four Americans suffer from major mental illness, and one out of four pastors also suffer from major mental illness. So that stat suggests very strongly that pastors are certainly not supermen or women, but they are humans who called to serve in a specific way. They themselves also suffer from the same, if not more, of the same issues that their parishioners, because of their high stress, their very high degree of isolation, and the other unique factors endemic to professional ministry. As both a clinical psychologist as well as a third-generation minister myself, those issues very much resonate to pastors whenever you are talking with them in a way they feel safe, that they can look at their stressors and deal with their issues. What the research shows very clearly, even within the churches, is that the best defense is a good offense. That is to talk about mental health issues, said Pingleton, who recently authored The Struggle is Real, a comprehensive resource that provides churches with practical tools to care for people struggling with mental and relational health issues in a biblically sound and emotionally healthy way. Bars explained that in his role as a seminarian training pastor, he tries to prepare them as best as he can for the real world challenges that comes with ministry, and he believes more seminaries need to make sure they are addressing issues of mental health as well. I spend my life teaching theology of ministry and challenging students to never give these simplistic, superficial answers to people who are hurting, but rather to weep with them and listen to them and not seek to be able to fix their problems, because many people have problems we can't fix. That's where Francis Schaeffer was very helpful. Working with him for years and years, he used to say, "What we're trying to do isn't difficult, it's impossible. We can't save anybody, but God can, so just stop trying to give superficial answers to people's problems. Many of our churches need to learn that, and some pastors need to learn it. We are trying to send pastors out who are understanding and who will be sympathetic and who have enough knowledge of their own brokenness so they don't try to heal other people's brokenness lightly." Research also shows that, among other things, churches need to better screen potential candidates for ordination and emphasize the importance of self-care for existing clergy. Last December, Bill Lentz, a Wisconsin pastor who dedicated much of his life to suicide prevention and whose ministry at Christ the Rock Community Church in Menasha was inspired by his dedication to the issue, stunned family and friends when he took his own life at 60. In perhaps the only public comment from his family embedded in his obituary, they urged those fighting depression against trying to fight it alone. Bill has never fallen victim to depression in the past, but has battled it with a vengeance for the last 3 months. He sought and accepted help, but unfortunately for all of us, it wasn't enough to give us more time with him here on earth. Our hope in Jesus Christ is the same today as it was before this nightmare began. Please, if you're struggling with depression, don't do it alone. Seek help.
Wow, that's the end?
Yep.
You know that paragraph where he's talking about Francis Schaeffer's quote, you know, working, we're trying to do isn't difficult, it's impossible. I think one of the things of our current, I'm going to at least say evangelical culture is, there seems to be this resurgence in Reformation theology and a discussion about it in particular, and where we see folks that have landed on this view that everything I've decided is the right way to see things. And they have a struggle, and they want to go head-to-head and vehemently fight against people with an opposite theological viewpoint, and they want to be very staunch. But I think part of the pitfall of that is, if you give to your congregation the idea that everything I think is absolutely, you know, rock solid, without a doubt, 100% sure, can't be debated, can't be interpreted differently, then you lead yourself into this place. You know, the way we do music is gospel, and the way we you know, do bus ministry, or the way we don't do bus ministry, or whatever it is, all those side things, if that's the only way to do it, you know, the only way to do it is to go into a theater and start a church that way, then you end up putting yourself in a position where, you know, the pastor and the people that you know, they have the market on truth, and so they're the only person you can go to, and there's nowhere else to go, and so then we end up with this isolationist type approach to things. Mm-hmm. And once again, we see in the Bible the opposite, which is a multitude of counselors, there's wisdom. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you almost even see the reference to several elders, the plurality of elders in the New Testament. It's like, okay, there wasn't just one guy running the church at Jerusalem or Antioch or any other city that there may have been. There were multiple people sharing the burden.
Yeah, it would be interesting to have the ability to study the pastors that commit suicide here and see what their relationship with the other shepherds was.
I don't even know that you could quantify that, could you?
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, because even with our ministry, we wouldn't be able to, I mean, out looking, you couldn't tell what your relationship is with other pastors. I mean, we know you go and fellowship with them periodically.
I mean within the circle.
Oh, within the circle?
You mentioned the elders within the congregation. Does the guy feel like he's doing it alone? Does he feel like he's on an island unto himself? Does he avail himself of other elders, you know, that type of perspective? Does he feel like the success and failure of the congregation rests on his shoulders and his alone, you know?
Yeah, and I don't know that the author necessarily addressed it, but I almost kind of wondered, to what degree does the personalization of problems fall into this? Mm-hmm. Because the acceptance of people, and as a pastor, I mean, you tell someone something they don't want to hear, and, you know, they can start bad-mouthing you, they can leave the church, and, you know, X number of things they can do that, you know, would bother the sinful human ego that we have, that if it's God's, you know, as opposed to just being said, it's God's word, and I'm sorry, you don't want to hear that what you're doing is sin, but, I mean, even some secondary, tertiary issues, it's like, well, they didn't like my solution to their problem, and now they're, you know, the relationship is hindered, and there's, you know, they haven't left the church, but there's a relational strife that some people take personally.
Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts or comments on this kind of challenging article? Yeah, I'd like to see one on soldiers. And I can't help but to wonder to what degree how we could help. That's the question I want to ask. How we could help. The army is trying to attack it from a sense of creating mental toughness, that the soldiers are not able to cope, coping mechanisms, coping strategies, the ability to fight through the struggle, to not throw in the towel, and I don't have any answers. I don't have all the answers. I don't have any answers.
It's a tough question, because I know over the last 30 years, I mean, there are times you feel totally overwhelmed, totally, you just don't know what to do.
Yeah.
And you reach that point, and, you know, you go ask somebody else, well, they don't have an answer either.
Nope.
You know, I'm overwhelmed. Sorry. So you get to the point, why do I go talk to anybody?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they can't help either.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes you just, I know it's cliche, but, I know for me, sometimes it's just been a matter of spending more time with God and trying to see, is there something something that's on me that somebody else could help with, and asking for help and shifting a little bit. And, you endure. You patiently get through it and, get to the other side.
Well, I know that from myself personally, rest is an important component to that issue, is that I need to unplug and rest. And I mean sleep is what I mean when I say rest. That's an important component. Everybody's got to identify what their components are. And then in the Army or the Department of Defense, I know that alcohol is a component to the entire problem. So you have someone who's exhausted and they're drunk. That's just a recipe for utter disaster right there. So,
did you ever have a soldier commit suicide in one of your units?
Mm-hmm. No, really thankful.
We did. Had a marital issue. And the command solution was, instead of get them to work it out, remove him from his home, put him in the barracks.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, his buddies brought him a few six-packs, and we found him hanging from a fire escape within 12 hours.
Yeah, right.
It was just, it was devastating to the morale of the unit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, listeners, thanks for listening to us. Maybe this helps you out there somewhere else with your church and your pastor. And certainly I would encourage you to pray. That's certainly one thing that you can do for sure, is to spend more time asking the sovereign God of the universe to strengthen and uplift your pastor. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.